Very good. Thank you, Mr. Haney. Well, we are ready to pick up the Nehemiah Bible study. I apologize for having such a long break in between studies. In my notes, we had the last installment back in the month of July, so I apologize for not getting back to this much more quickly than we have. But we are back on schedule with that now, and today we'll pick up with Nehemiah chapter 10. As you probably do not recall, we finished last time in chapter 9 with the prayer or the psalm of the Levites. And it was a song that basically decried the fact that they had been sinning, had to be sent into captivity, and then God mercifully drew them back out, placed them in the land, and now they have a responsibility to be obedient to God. And certainly when we, as members of the family of God, look back and realize that God has called us, He's drawn us, it should likewise give us a motivation to stay faithful to Him because of the tremendous blessings we've been given. And that leads us up then to chapter 10. And as we mentioned last time, this contract or this psalm that the Levites sang, in essence, was the precursor. It was the beginning to the contract that all of Judea now, or the Jews at least, and the Benjamites, the Levites, were going to make with God to recommit themselves to God's way of life. Now, anytime you have a situation like this, where people had been living God's way to a degree, they left God's way, now they're coming back, there will be certain things in their personal life, or in this case, the life of the community, that they were doing very badly. There'll be other areas that they may have kept up a little better. For example, it's often been said that the best kept law in the church of God is the law of clean and unclean meats. People can leave the church and for some reason all they do is not eat pigs or lobster or shrimp. Now others do, but I've known people who've come back to the church after 15 or 20 years and the only thing they kept during all that time was the laws about clean and unclean meats. For some reason they wouldn't eat those things. Now, threw away a lot more important things, but nonetheless, they were doing that. So what we have here in the situation is that Judah had been doing certain things, but they have been falling apart or falling away on any number of other things. So as they reorganize and kind of recommit themselves to God, there are some key issues that were of importance to them that they identify in this recommittal to God. And we'll look at some of those as we begin. Now we will be able to make pretty good speed through the first 27 verses because it's just a list of names. Now, what is interesting, of course, about the list of names is that these are the individuals who sign the contract, who maybe sign on the dotted line. You almost get the sense of like a Declaration of Independence. You all have a picture in your mind of the Declaration of Independence. You got all these signatures in a row. And then, of course, you got John Hancock, the giant one that stands out. But each of these individuals, John Hancock signed that, by the way, saying, "I want King George to be able to read my name without hesitation." Anyway, sidelight. Nonetheless, that's why he signed it so big. What we have is this list of individuals, but they're not just individuals. These people represent entire clans and families. So while we have this list, in one sense, a small list in the first 27 verses of maybe 100 names, or thereabouts, not quite that, we're representing thousands of people because each of these would be heads of households, heads of families, heads of miniature tribes, we might say, patriarchs within the family. In this list are any number of people, and their roles in society were royalty. Some of the government officials clearly were signing here. Priests were signing. Levites were signing specifically. It mentions in verse 1, "Now those who placed their seal on the document." were. And first it lists Nehemiah. He was the first one to sign. He might have been the John Hancock of this document, making sure his name was up to that. He, as leader, dedicated himself to this recommitment to God. Goes on through the first 8 verses or so. You might notice at the end of verse 8, it says, Amaziah, Bilgai, and Shemaiah, these were the priests. So it looks like there's a combination of government officials and priests in that first 8 verses or so. Verse 9 then says, the Levites. We have 17 now listed from there onward of Levites who'd signed the document as well. Verse 14 talks about the leaders of the people. So again, you've got this mix of political leaders, of religious leaders, priests and Levites. So representative of the entirety of the society. So you can read through that list of names if you'd like to challenge your ability to do pronunciations. Otherwise, we'll just skip down to the actual agreement. First it lists who, now it lists what are they agreeing to. Now as you go through this, you likewise can say, well, are there things that I can learn from this? Are there areas of my life that maybe need a recommittal? Now as we mentioned, in a recommittal, we could put a lot of things. We could put all 10 commandments. We could put the holy days, clean, unclean meats, tithing, lots of things we could put in there. But the issues that Judah was specifically dealing with that were the biggest problems are the things that come up in this recommittal. And in verse 28, we begin to read that. Now the rest of the people, the priests, the Levites, the gatekeepers, the singers, the Nethinim, and all those who'd separated themselves from the peoples of the lands to the law of God. We'll pause there for a second. Priests, Levites, gatekeepers. Gatekeepers were the ones that stood on the gate with the sword, opened and closed the gates, allowed people to come in. They were always Levites. So gatekeepers were a special category of Levites. The singers, likewise, were all Levites. They were professional musicians who produced music for the worship of God. The Nethinim were individuals who were not physically Jews, but had been living in the land when God granted the land to the, from the Canaanites to the Jews. And they, in essence, tricked Israel into saying, oh, we're not from local, we're from far away. Well, they promised them they wouldn't kill them because they were from so far away. Then they found out they lived, okay, a mile away. Well, that's kind of far if you have to walk. So these people were spared and they were made servants. So the Nethinim are those people of the land who were servants primarily to the Levites. But anyway, most of them over the course of time had become worshipers of the true God, and the influence from the Levites was a very good thing for them. But all of these, it says in verse 28, who had separated themselves from the people of the lands to the law of God, they were trying to exclusively live by God's law. Then it says their wives, their sons, and their daughters, everyone who had knowledge and understanding. So, God's truth, God's covenant, committal to God's way, does not require someone to be an old person. No better time than to commit to God's way of life when very young, as soon as you have understanding. That's what's happening here. Verse 29, it says, these joined with their brethren, their nobles, and entered into a curse and an oath to walk in God's law. Now, isn't it interesting the way this is stated? We know it's this group of leaders, the brethren, the nobles, the Levites, the Nethinim, the priests, all these government officials, they entered into, it says, a curse. Now, again, ideally, we might say, well, it'd be so much better if they entered into a blessing. Because there are blessings, and yet there are blessings and cursings. You're all familiar with Deuteronomy 28 and the issues of, if you obey me, here's the blessings. You get done with those first 14 verses or so of blessings, and then verse 15 and 16 starts, but if you disobey me, here comes the list of curses. So in essence, they're promising on a negative here, that if we don't do this, may God curse us. Now, why would we say they enter into this kind of agreement? Well, this kind of agreement has more teeth, we might say. You're more obligated when you say, well, I'm going to obey God and ask for His blessing. Okay, that's nice. But it's far more incumbent on us if we say, if I don't do this, may God curse me. Boy, that ups the ante quite a bit. Takes on personal responsibility. They're entering into a curse and an oath to walk in God's law. If I worship other gods, may God curse me and my descendants and my crops. Boy, that's a heavy promise. So hopefully, you see, the idea was that it would impact people much more so than, oh, I'll try to be good. Okay, that's nice to say. But if I say, God, would you please curse me if I disobey you? Wow, that's a heavy responsibility. That brings on personal responsibility. Now, I'm not saying that as we get down on our knees each day that we pray this way. God, if I disobey today, please curse me. If you're like me, it happens. Curses happen quickly enough without asking for them. At the same time, we understand how serious they were about this. God, if I don't live by your law, then please curse us. Curse me as an individual, curse my family, curse... And again, what's the purpose of the curse? It's not to punish primarily, it's to bring about repentance. So penalties were to bring about repentance. But you can certainly understand their attitude, that they were really committed to this. They really wanted to do it right. So they entered into a curse and an oath to walk in God's law, which was given by Moses, the servant of God, and to observe and do all the commandments of the eternal, or the Lord our Lord, and His ordinances and His statutes. So they wanted to have everything covered. Now, one of the things that just is an interesting sidelight that comes in at this point is that we wonder where the genesis was of groups like the Pharisees. Well, some scholars will trace it back to this point in Judah's history, that they'd been through any number of years of curses under Babylonian captivity. They get back to the land. They still only partially obey God. They have more curses, more troubles. Nehemiah finally comes onto the scene, and probably under the tutelage of Ezra as the main prophet, we might say, at this time, very likely. The nation makes a recommittal to God. And they're bound and determined. They've entered into a curse that if we don't do this, curse us. And we are committing to the law of Moses, all the commandments, all the statutes, all the ordinances. In other words, we're going to follow this in every single minute detail. And it seems that from this time onward, slowly but surely, the sect of the Pharisees begins to grow. And these are the individuals that are watching every tiny little detail. So hundreds of years later, when we get to the time of Christ, they're literally counting out tiny seeds and saying, 9 for me, 1 for God. 9 for me, 1 for God. Instead of taking a bucket, say it's 10 pounds, scoop out about a pound, tithe on it. It's kind of, oh, we got to be precise about this. So it's very likely that from this time onward, it's this attitude that somehow grows out of proportion and becomes this detailed, specific, ritualistic kind of faith that actually came into conflict with the truth as Christ taught it. So when we finish verse 29, they've committed to doing all these things in every detail. If not, may God curse me. And again, you understand then when we get to that issue of the Pharisees in the early New Testament, how they really thought that if they didn't do these things, they were going to be cursed. Now, a good dose of self-righteousness is dumped in there as well. There's no question about that. That we're better than everybody else because we do these things. But again, you can understand the attitude. Now, what were some of the things that were issues in their day that they recommitted to and made an issue of because they had been a problem up to this point? The first one is in verse 30. It's intermarriage. Intermarriage with the people of the land. Verse 30. The first thing they committed to, in addition to the law, the statutes, the ordinances. Here were some specific issues now. Intermarriage, verse 30. We would not give our daughters as wives to the people of the land, nor take their daughters for our sons. What was the point? If you are spiritually intermarried, life is harder. Things are just harder that way. You don't have the freedoms to do with God's way as you would if you were not married outside of the faith. Now, we talked about that a great deal when we went through the book of Ezra. So no need in Ezra chapter 9, as I recall, no need to go over that again now. But it's just wise if young people in the church or old people in the church, doesn't matter. If we think about this, life is far easier being married to a converted person than it is an unconverted person. It's just the reality of the situation. So, again, they're saying we want to be sure that we keep our people separate. Second issue, that of Sabbath keeping. Verse 31, if the peoples of the land brought wares or any grain to sell on the Sabbath day, we would not buy it from them on the Sabbath or on a holy day. We'll pause there. Sabbath issues were something that was plaguing the Jews of this day. So in addition to intermarriage, they wanted to focus specifically on this, that we recommit to the keeping of the Sabbath. Now, we'll cover this much more in detail when we get to Nehemiah chapter 13, because there's a great deal of that chapter that talks specifically about this very issue. So what they were saying is that, okay, if people bring things in to sell, we're just not going to buy. All of us who signed on the dotted line. Now, there would have been some who didn't sign on the dotted line who thought this was just fine. But they're saying we're going to be obedient to God. Now, we again have talked in the past about the sacredness of the Sabbath and that it's not a shopping day. We don't go out shopping on the Sabbath day. It's holy time. It's not to be defiled by just common everyday stuff like we would normally do any other day of the week. So they recognize that stores, quote unquote, would be open, but we're not going to go shopping. That's for another time. Now again, we've understood that sometimes there's a legitimate ox in the ditch and we have to exchange money on the Sabbath for various reasons. And again, we'll talk more about those things as we get to chapter 13, because that's the topic of a good part of that chapter. But they're simply not going to do the regular shopping kinds of things. Run to the market, get distracted with all those things on the Sabbath day, or, of course, on the holy days. And, of course, that stems not only from Exodus chapter 20 and the Ten Commandments and Leviticus chapter 23, the holy days, but other areas as well. So we would not buy it from them on the Sabbath or on a holy day. Now, the end of verse 31 also says, and we would forego the seventh year's produce and the exacting of every debt. So what this is speaking about, not only would be keeping the Sabbath day and the holy days, they would also be keeping the sabbatical or Sabbath year. Now, as you may recall, that when God called Israel and drew them out of Egypt, He gave them instruction about the sabbatical or seventh or Sabbath year. That every seventh year would be a Sabbath year in which the land would rest. The idea was they would not cultivate the land. Whatever grew up on its own, the animals would eat. The poor would be able to glean from the fields of these volunteers that just grew up. Or if it was a vineyard, the grapes would be left hanging and the poor could go collect them. So in one sense, it was a type of welfare system or assistance system for the poor. It was also designed to allow the land to rest, so it could rejuvenate. So as these animals trudged through what was normally croplands, they would eat, they would deposit, the land would be refreshed as a result. It would be fertilized. So the Sabbath year, or the seventh year, was to be kept by the entire nation. So not only was it an issue of land health, not only was it an issue of helping the poor, it was also an issue of faith. And that probably was the primary lesson God desired out of it. That as a nation, we're not going to cultivate during this seventh year. We're going to trust God to take care of us. So we'll trust Him during the first 6 years to provide enough that we can put some aside so that we don't have to go ahead during the seventh year and have a huge harvest. Because like, you know, Joseph would have done in Egypt, during the 5 years of the, you know, of the famine, or the six years of famine, they'd put aside all during those good years, so when the famine came, they would be able to eat during the course of the famine. They didn't have a need in that sense to cultivate. They had prepared properly. So again, God says, I'll give you enough from the sixth to take you through the seventh. Certainly God's people would have been, had they been keeping this properly, been preparing up till the seventh year. Certainly God would see that preparation and bless them as a result. Also during this sabbatical year, all debts were to be forgiven. So the chronic economic troubles that we have from today certainly could be solved if God's laws were enacted on a national scale, or certainly an international scale. The crushing kind of debt that people have simply wouldn't exist. Number one, if I'm a lender, I would be very careful about giving out loans if I realized that if they're not paid back by the seventh year, they're erased. Boy, credit's going to be very challenging then. In other words, people are going to work and they're going to save and they're going to take that savings and buy. Instead of take the credit card, buy, and hope that then I can somehow pay it off as I go along. So the whole economic concept is different. Instead of living in a credit world, you begin living in a cash world. And the economy becomes much more stable as a result. So that's what they agreed to do. They would forego the seventh year's produce. They would start keeping the Sabbath year, the sabbatical year, and the exacting of every debt. In other words, in conjunction with that seventh year, all debts that are come about in that seventh year would be forgiven. So it was a great system, and they at least agreed to do it. Whether or not they actually carried it out very well, is certainly up to judgment. It doesn't seem like it lasted very long, but at least this is what they were committing to. Then a third issue. In addition to intermarriage and Sabbath keeping, a third issue that was specifically important to them was support of the work of God. Support of the work of God. Verse 32. Also, we made ordinances for ourselves to exact from ourselves yearly 1/3 of a shekel for the service of the house of our God. In other words, one of the things that clearly had plagued them up to this point was a neglect of the temple. It had been rebuilt. It was now strong and solid. But how would it stay that way? It's fine to build something, but if we don't maintain it, we have just as big a problem, if not a bigger problem, later on. So they set up what came to be called the temple tax. Now, it's not called the temple tax here. It was a voluntary offering, and that's the idea behind it. But because of abuse and because the temple complex eventually came to be controlled by Gentiles, you know, by the time of Christ, this was all area controlled by Gentiles. In this case, then it was the temple tax, something we've got to pay. It started out as something we want to pay. So that would be for the upkeep of the temple and all the aspects that needed to be taken care of. It is interesting, again, when you study some of these things, sometimes people get lost in the forest and can't see the forest for the tree. You know, so lots of questions come up. Well, why is it a third of the shekel? Because back in the time of Moses, when he asked for the original offering to make sure the tabernacle could keep going, he asked for half a shekel. So why do they reduce it from half to a third? And you can read literally pages and pages of information as to try to explain what the difference is. Some will say, well, you know, economic times were harder. You know, we're talking Cleveland, you know, 2012. Economic times are hard, so they reduced it from a half to a third. Others say, no. The Babylonian shekel is what they're really talking about here. And as a result of it being a third of a Babylonian shekel, that was equal to a half of the Hebrew shekel back during the time of Moses. So they're actually charging the same. Who cares? It just doesn't matter. But it shows how people can get all tied up in details and spend hundreds of hours of their lives and time on absolutely worthless information. And it's so sad to see you miss the point. The point is, support the work of God. Make sure, if this is of value to you, that we put money into it so that it continues. It's as simple as that. The amount is not the issue. The fact that they were dedicated to God's work and seeing it go forward was the issue. So, the service in the house of God. Here's what it was for, verse 33. For the showbread. God said there should be bread brought in every day to the temple. At the end of the day, that bread would be taken out and it would be eaten by the priests. But it was fresh bread every day to honor God, to thank Him for the great blessings He's given. It wasn't going to go to waste there and rot. Then the priests were to take it the next day and eat it. For the regular grain offering, for the regular burnt offerings of the Sabbath, the new moons and the set feasts, for the holy things, for the sin offerings, to make atonement for Israel, and all the work of the house of our God. So the regular functioning of the temple services was funded by the temple tax. Now you say, well, what about the tithes? Oh, tithes certainly were there as well. This was in addition to regular tithes. This was a special offering for the functioning of things that would go on every day at the temple. Now, as a secondary part to that, verse 34 talks about another issue of this agreement or this contract, this covenant. And that is the order and structure of worship. As part of supporting the work, in essence, or you could put this as a fourth issue, order and structure of worship in the temple was reset. It says verse 34, we cast lots among the priests, the Levites, and the people for bringing the wood offering into the house of our God. In other words, you've got burnt offerings every day, one in the morning, one in the evening. Plus, then you've got people who are bringing offerings in to be burnt as well. Where do you get the fuel to do this? Well, a lot of times people, as you know, might bring their own fuel, their own wood to burn an offering that they were giving. And again, sometimes we don't think of these things. Well, they just gave a sacrifice. Well, who provides the wood for the sacrifice to be burnt on? Who provides the water for the sprinkling and for the washing of these pieces of meat that before they were offered? Somebody's got to do all that. So all these things go on behind the scenes, in essence. You got Nethinims hauling water day after day into the temple, filling up the bath there where the meat would be washed before it was offered on the sacrificials. You got somebody bringing in wood every single day. Got somebody lighting the fires, all these things being done. Sometimes we don't think of all those details. But in this case, it says they cast lots among the priests, the Levites, and the people for bringing the wood offering into the house of God. So they set up a system whereby every group would have their day or their month or their week, however they set it. Doesn't tell us how they set it up, but at their appointed times throughout the year. It says, according to our fathers' houses, at the appointed times year by year, to burn on the altar of the eternal our God as it is written in the law. Okay, God says, burn this offering, light the wood. But he doesn't say, how do you get the wood? Where do you get it from? What kind of wood is it? See, the Pharisee's mind says, well, what is clean wood and what is unclean wood? Cherry would be probably clean wood. Dogwood, now dogs are unclean. I'm kidding. You can see where the Pharisee's mind starts to go. God didn't tell us. We better make a decision on this. We better make a rule about this. In this case, they simply said, okay, the coons are bringing wood. the first week of the month. And then the Reynolds bring it the second. And then the Webster's the third week. And then the Roop's the fourth week. And then the fifth week is Mr. Bond. So all of these are set up week by week, maybe month by month, year after year, so that wood is provided. And again, by separating it out amongst all the families, you get wood from all different locations. You don't deforest an entire area by getting wood to burn the sacrifices. So a good system that was set up. So it was something that, since it's already set up, nobody's looking at somebody else. Well, I thought you were bringing it this week. Well, I thought you were bringing it. I brought it 2 weeks ago. It's your turn to bring it. It's already scheduled, already set up. So there needs to be a certain amount of organization for the temple to function, and of course today for the church to function. So they cast lots, they divided it all up, verse 35, and we made ordinances to bring the first fruits of our ground and the first fruits of all of our trees year by year to the house of the Eternal. So in addition to the issues of intermarriage, Sabbath keeping, support of the work, structure of worship, they also wanted to be sure that they were obeying God in this area of first fruits as well. Now we'll take a few moments, because we don't often talk about first fruits. If you want to take your card out and put it here in Nehemiah chapter 10. And turn with me, if you would, to Exodus chapter 23. We talked about this issue of first fruits in the church 30 or 40 years ago much more frequently. And that was because the constitution of the church 30 or 40 years ago was far more agricultural in basis than it was than it is today, I should say. When I came to the church, first started attending in 1974 in Wisconsin, probably three quarters of the church were farmers in the church area that I attended in. It was an unusual person who worked an office job. Most of the folks were farm folks. So this issue of first fruits, what do I do? What's my obligation to God when I grow something? Do I tithe on it? How do I tithe on it? And what about these first fruit things? What we have as a basic understanding is that if I grow things, God says, bring that which the land produces year by year, the increase that the land produces, bring it year by year, bring that tithe every year. So if I grow 10 ears of corn, I bring one ear of corn and give it to God. If, obviously in this case, in today's economy, it's not reasonable for me to bring an ear of corn to church, I sell all the corn and my profit, I take 10% of that profit, and that's the tithe to God. But that is separate from the first fruits. The first fruits were a special offering that was given by the individual to, again, thank God for the productivity of the land, to thank God for the wonderful blessing that he gave. So they were just the first few ripe things that came from the land before they even began to think about tithing and the increase that you would figure after the harvest was brought in. Exodus chapter 23 and verse 19. It says, the first or the first fruits of your land you shall bring into the house of the Eternal your God. That's all it says. Then it goes on to talk about this seething a kid in its mother's milk, separate topic. We won't go on to that. But it simply makes this statement, the first of the first fruits are God's. And again, the principle is that when God blesses us with things that grow out of the ground, the first couple things ripe, we give back to God as a thank you, as an acknowledgement that he is the source of these blessings. Now, it simply says the first fruits. It doesn't say how much is the first of the first fruits. Is it the very first one? We got 800 tomato plants and the first ripe tomato is God's? Or is it a representative? Here's several that represent the harvest that we'll take out of this field or off of this crop. He doesn't tell us how much it is. It, again, is a personal issue. So from time to time, you still may see bags appear over here on our table that simply say, here's some of the first fruits. Here's the first onions we plucked out of the garden. Here's the first carrot. It's also nice if it's washed and bagged, but that's a whole other separate issue. In some cases, When we think of the first fruits, it might be a very small little bit. I have a small garden. I have a couple tomato plants. Here's a tomato. I grow hundreds of acres of corn. Here's a bushel of corn. You know, okay, all kinds of things like that could be the possibility. Turn to Numbers chapter 18. It is a small way, again, of saying to God, I appreciate very much you blessing us. I thank you for the miracle of crops that grow, that we have a chance to actually watch and participate in that process, to help grow things that show your creative power. It's, again, it's a small offering. They were to be brought to the house of God. In modern times, we've simply given them to the ministry to use as they see fit. Chapter 18, beginning in verse 12. All the best of the oil, the best of the wine, of the wheat, the first fruits of them, which they shall offer unto the Eternal, I have given you. So in this case, when these first fruits were brought in, and it shows in this case that many in Israel, at least at this time, would come to God with the best. Those first fruits were the best of things. And they would give them to God. And God simply says, I'm giving them to the priest to help you sustain yourselves. Now the priests aren't to be enriching themselves, but they're to be sustaining themselves. And that certainly was the concept here. So all the best of the oil, best of the wine, wheat, first fruits of them which shall offer unto the Eternal, have I given you. And again, that's referring to Aaron and his children, if you refer back to verse 8. Verse 13, whatsoever is first ripe in the land, which they shall bring unto the Eternal, shall be yours. And everyone that's clean in your house shall eat of it. So again, it was one of the ways that God was shown thankfulness for what he had done. The very first things ripe. So since we have a little garden on the side of our home, we bring every so often to the coons during the growing season. Here's a couple tomatoes. Here's a couple beans. Here's a couple whatever it might be. So it was for the priesthood in that sense to help sustain them during the course of time. And again, the idea, the concept is that we give this to God and it's a thank you. And he'll bless us as a result because we're putting him first. We're acknowledging that this is where those blessings come from. So, verse 35 again, we made ordinances to bring the first fruits of the ground and the first fruits of all fruit trees, the fruit of all fruit trees, year by year to the house of the Eternal. And again, when we say they made ordinances, they took what was written here. First fruits, small little sentences written about first fruits. Give the first of the first fruits to God. Doesn't say how much. Doesn't say all the time throughout the year. What happens if we have a second crop? Do we do that? We had hay farmers in Wisconsin years ago saying, okay, do I give God the first of the first fruits from the first cutting of hay or the first of the first from the first cutting and then the second cutting? And if I get a third cutting in, how do we do this? Well, you could see why they had to make ordinances. They had to start to make rules. Well, God says, give it. Now, what ideally would happen is you've got God's Spirit. Just, you know, pray, ask God to give you wisdom as to how to handle this, and go ahead and take care of it. Everybody will handle it slightly differently, but you've got God's Spirit. Work it out. In this case, now we have to have a rule about this. So if there are apple trees, here's how many are the first of the first fruits of apples, because apples take a lot longer to ripen than some other fruits. So plums, small maybe first fruits there, because they ripen very rapidly, and when they're ripe, they're really ripe, you better get them off the tree, or you're going to have prunes all over the ground. So in this case, they made ordinances. We simply say, let God guide you as you pray about it, as you fast about it, to decide how best to handle that situation. Then it goes on in verse 36, an additional aspect to this. Verse 36, to bring the firstborn of our sons and our cattle, as it is written in the law, and the firstborn of our herds and flocks, to the house of our God, to the priests who minister in the house of God. What was the situation here? Remember when God slew, when he put to death the firstborn in Egypt? What did he tell Israel? He said, in essence, these should have been your dead, so your firstborn is now mine. I'll take the firstborn. Now, later on, he did say that I have replaced the firstborn with the Levites. But God literally said at the beginning, the firstborn were going to be his servants. That doesn't mean it would be sacrificed. It means it would be his servants. Again, shortly thereafter, he said, I'll let you keep the firstborn, but I'll take the Levites instead of the firstborn. But he did expect that when we had a firstborn, there would be a special offering given. So the firstborn of our sons was an offering. It says the firstborn of the cattle. Sometimes literally they gave the cattle. There are many laws that describe what the Bible talks about as the calf or the sheep or the goat that opens the matrix. In other words, when a ewe, let's say, has its very first lamb, that was God's. It was the one that opened the matrix. In other words, began the birthing process. So that was God's. And so they would give that animal to God as a sacrifice. They would participate in that, of course. You may not realize that most of the sacrifices that were given by individuals in Israel were actually killed by the individual. When you brought a sacrifice, you'd be the one to slit the throat and drain the blood there by the altar with the priest. Now, they would take it from there. Later on, of course, as time went on, people didn't participate virtually at all in the sacrifices. It was strictly a priest duty. But that's not the way God described it originally. God wanted every individual involved in that process as they went through those sacrifices. It became much more personal as to, I have caused a death by my sins. This animal has to die. So let's get back to this. The firstborn of our sons and our cattle, as it is written in the law, and you can take some time to look into that if you'd like, back in Leviticus. The firstborn of our herds and flocks to the house of our God, to the priests who minister in the house of God. So again, this would be one of the ways in which the worshipers would honor God, and it would also be the way in which the priests and the Levites would have sustenance on a regular basis. Verse 37, to bring the first fruits of our dough, our offerings, the fruit from all kinds of trees, the new wine and oil to the priests, to the storerooms of the house of our God, and to bring the tithes of our land. So after all these other things, then he also mentions, oh, by the way, the tithes as well, the tithes of our land to the Levites, for the Levites should receive tithes in all our farming communities. So if there were Levites that lived in the communities, they would receive tithes from the farmers in that area. Again, it was a very personal issue that we're supporting the work of God. We're supporting God's system. Verse 38, and the priest, the descendant of Aaron, shall be with the Levites when the Levites receive tithes. Should be, in that sense, a supervisor. Now again, we trust, we hope everyone's honest, but it's not bad to have a supervisor. Somebody keep an eye on the whole process. The priest, the descendant of Aaron, that's the high priest, shall be with the Levites when the Levites receive tithes. And the Levites shall bring up a tenth of the tithes to the house of our God, to the rooms of the storehouse. So that's interesting. The Levites would bring a tenth of the tithe to the house of our God, to the rooms of the storehouse. Now, what is this issue being described in verses 38 and 39? It goes on to say in verse 39, we'll explain this. For the children of Israel and the children of Levi shall bring the offering of the grain, the new wine, the oil, to the storerooms where the articles of the sanctuary are, where the priests who minister and the gatekeepers and singers are, and will not neglect the house of our God. So what's being described apparently in verses 38 and 39 is that when the tithe comes in, the Levites separate a tithe of that. You've heard the phrase before, the tithe of the tithe. So the Levites receive the tithe, then they were to separate it into 10 parts, take out one part, in other words, a tithe of the tithe they'd received, and that would go into the storehouses specifically for the maintenance of the temple. to make sure things kept running the way that they should. It mentions articles of the sanctuary will not neglect the house of our God. So apparently what was being described is at this time they set aside 1/10 of the tithe for the maintenance of the house of God and everything to do with it. Now they would have to judge how to use that. Apparently the high priest made the final decisions on that. But it was the tithe of the tithe. Now you've probably heard that phrase and participated in tithe of the tithe in a little bit different manner. Of all the tithe that came in this case it was to support the priests and the Levites. 1/10 of that was removed to take care of the physical stuff. Tithe of the tithe. Mr. Armstrong saw this principle many, many years ago. It was actually brought to his attention. This concept of tithe of the tithe. And it was then used in regard to festival tithe or second tithe. And the way that was decided is we read the principle here that the Levites set aside 1/10 of God's tithe for the maintenance of the house, for the stuff in the temple. The roof had to be repaired every so often. The leaks had to be fixed. Everything had to be taken care of, plus the regular service. You use a gold laver, after a while, what happens? You put gold in fire, what happens? It starts to look pretty ratty, pretty ugly. So to polish it, to recoat it, all those things would take money. Tithe the tithers for that. Mr. Armstrong saw that principle and said, when we keep the Feast of Tabernacles and all of the other holy days, it is seemingly right to pay for any expenses for those holy days out of the second tithe. So that's certainly reasonable. For example, we go to the feast, we rent a hall to be able to have church services in. It costs money to rent that hall. So we could have, and for many years did, take money out of first tithe to pay for the rental of that hall. Mr. Armstrong said, feast expenses really ought to be all out of second tithe or festival tithe. So let's ask the brethren to act on this principle in Nehemiah and take a tithe of their second tithe, give it to the church to take care of those festival expenses. So we've been doing that now for several decades, probably 40 years. In that sense, what happens as you give, as I give a tithe of my second tithe, of your second tithe, to the church, that goes into the festival fund, and that is used then for all these festival expenses. In time past, it was used to produce the booklet that showed where you can get housing. Where the activities are going to be during the feast. When you received in the mail that festival brochure that had articles in it, a list of all the sites and all the housing facilities, that was paid for out of this tithe of the second tithe. So tithe of the second tithe is not found specifically in the Bible. But the principle of it certainly is here. So Mr. Armstrong said it would be reasonable to ask the brethren to give 10% of their second tithe to take care of these. Now, we could do it differently. We could all arrive at the feast and throw a 20 or a 50 or a 100 in the pot, whatever it might take to pay for the rental of this facility. That certainly is possible, to take care of the rental of the family day activity or this or that or all the various expenses. We could ask for a donation, charge you 50 cents for the festival brochure that shows the schedule of what's going on during the week. That's all possible. But it seemed to be a much more reasonable thing to have tithe the tithe set up and have that taken care of automatically. So as feast expenses come up during the year, there is a pot of money, we may as well say, that is second tithe that specifically would be used for those expenses. So, that's in essence what happened. And I might mention how that works for us in the ministry. We tithe as well. We second tithe as well. And we tithe of the tithe as well. Years ago, it was decided that rather than give the ministry their full salary, we will take out their festival tithe. So you have deductions on your paycheck. I have deductions on my paycheck, and one of those is the festival tithe, and that is simply set aside. Then, just before the fall, spring feast, and then before the fall feast, it is sent to me. a portion sent in the spring, and a portion sent in the fall. But what is deducted is 9% of my salary. 1% is deducted and goes straight into the tithe of the tithe fund, the festival tithe fund. So that's the way it works for us. Now, it's rather handy to have it done that way. It also helps the cash flow of the church to have some money in reserve. So when you've got, in this case, what do we have, 50 employees or 60 employees, something like that, and their tithe is sitting in a bank account, it's a nice little cushion there. Until the fall feast comes, then it deletes or depletes the entire fund, and it starts over now in October or November. So that's the way it works for the ministry, in case you've ever wondered. So in regard to first tithe, it was judged it's not a good idea to make that an automatic deduction. It's too impersonal. So I am sent the 90% of my salary, and I'm expected to tithe just like you are. God expects that of me. So that's done individually. That's sent in just like you send it in. So those are the way things are work in that regard. So with that, we'll close out with this chapter. If you have any questions on those things, please let me know. One other thing I'll mention in verse 39, that's always a personal issue to me. It says that these... This tithe of the tithe was used for the various aspects of the tabernacle or the temple. But it says at the end of verse 39, where the priests who minister and the gatekeepers and the singers are. Again, I'll just point out that part of the worship of God that was to be supported, was to be taken care of, was the singing. Music was to be a part of the worship, so much so that it was to be financially supported along the way. Now, we as a church have never really come to the point where we've employed professional musicians to be able to produce music in the church. Someday, my hope is that that will be a reality, because there are some really, really talented people who could do wonderful things for music in the church if they had the opportunity to spend their full time and attention on that. This, of course, was one of the reasons we pushed very hard when we were asked to do a hymnal. It's got to be the real thing. It's got to be the big thing. It's got to be hardcover. It's got to be full. Can't do this little paperback thing. If music is important to us, we've got to do it right. And so that's the result we sing from every week, which is wonderful to see. But singing is a very important thing. Other animals sing, but not the way human beings do. It's a true expression of our thoughts, our character, our heart, and that's a wonderful thing. All right, with that, we'll go ahead and close for today. We're not going to get through chapter 11, which we probably should have done, but we'll get that next time. So we'll call it quits for today, and go ahead and have one of our non-professional singers lead us in the closing hymn.